and was a priest. I take another breath. Right after my arrest in Ohio, while I was sitting in jail, I started thinking about my life. I was 22 years old. I had been an alcoholic and drug addict for a decade. I hated myself. I didn't see a future, and the only thing in my past was wreckage and disaster. I decided that I wanted to die. When I got out and jumped bail, I flew back to Paris. When I got to my apartment, I drank a bottle of whiskey and wrote a note. All it said was, "Don't mourn me." I left it on top of my bed, and I went out, and I started walking toward the nearest bridge. A lot of Parisians kill themselves that way, by throwing themselves into the Seine. You jump, hit the water, and you either die on impact or you drown. As I was walking, I started crying. Crying because I had wasted my life and made such a mess of it, and crying because I was happy it was finally going to end. I also started getting scared. Scared because killing yourself isn't an easy thing to do, and I knew that when I did it, everything was over. I don't believe there's a heaven or anything resembling it. Life just ends. I take a breath. I saw a church, and I was getting so scared that I was having trouble walking. I figured I could go inside, and it would be quiet and empty, and I could sit by myself and think. I found an empty pew, and I sat down, and I just cried. For a long time, I just sat there by myself and cried. I take a deep breath. The fury that faded while I had been speaking starts to rise again. After a while, a man, dressed like you, approached me and asked me if I was all right. I told him no. He introduced himself as a father. He told me that he had a lot of experience counseling young people, and that if I wanted to talk to him about my troubles, we should go back to his office and talk. I said, no, I'd like to be alone. He sat down next to me and said we should go back to his office. He told me that he was sure he could help me. Just come back to my office. Just come back to my office. I figured it couldn't hurt, so I went. I take another breath. The fury has risen. I speak. His office was one of a series of rooms behind the altar. When we got there, the father locked the door behind us. I should have known right fucking then, but he was a priest and it didn't cross my mind. I sat down on a couch and he sat down next to me, and he asked what was wrong, and I told him. I told him about my addictions, about the shitty life I had led, about the disaster I had just run from, and about my plan to kill myself. The whole time I talked, he sat and stared at me and pretended to be listening. When I finished, he reached over and put his hand on my thigh and said, "You have come to the right place. I believe I can help you." I didn't like his hand there, so I moved it. He put it back, and he said, "Although God has sent me to you, there is something you must give me in return." I moved his hand off again, and I asked him, "What?" And he put his hand back and he put it higher on my thigh, and he said, "I know you are upset and confused right now, but you must not resist or fight God's will. We were put together for a reason." And he started moving his hand up my thigh toward my crotch. I moved it away and told him not to do that again. He said, "Okay," but he put it back, and this time he put it on my crotch, and he started to reach for my face with his other hand. As he did, he said, "You must not resist God's will, my son." I stare at Father David. The fury is up, up, up. I feel what I felt that night. The urge to kill, destroy, annihilate. I didn't give that motherfucker a chance to touch my face. I hit him on the point of his chin, and I heard a crack, and the blood started to flow. I stood up and hit him again. I did it again and again and again. I don't know how many times I did it, but at a certain point, all I could see was blood. After I was through with his face, and after he was knocked out, I pulled him off the couch and I spread his legs. I spread them so I could kick him, and I did. I kicked him about 15 times as hard as I fucking could. I kicked him to the point that he was moaning, even though he was unconscious. Then I turned, and I unlocked his door, and I walked out, and I went to the nearest liquor store and bought as much whiskey as I could with the money I had with me, and I found an alley, and I sat there, and I got fucking drunk till I passed out. When I woke up the next morning, I went home. For the next few days, I kept expecting the police to come see me or to arrest me, but it didn't happen. I checked the papers for a couple of weeks to see if there was some mention of what I had done, but there was nothing. I can only imagine that the priest had done to others what he had tried to do to me, and that if he lived through what I did to him, and I think he did, he knew if he went to the police I would tell them why I did it, and if they looked into my claims, there would have been others to substantiate them. Father David looks away from me. He takes a deep breath and shakes his head. I keep speaking. I don't know if I lost the courage to kill myself or I gained the strength not to, but I didn't do it. I kept living and drinking and doing drugs and fucking up. Eventually, I ended up here. Unlike the rest of what I told you about, I don't feel regret or remorse about what I did to that priest. And to be honest, I think he deserved it. But it has haunted me. At that moment when I was kicking that priest, I could have killed him. And I wanted to kill him. And knowing that I was capable of doing that and willing to do it and out of control enough to do it scared the shit out of me. I don't want to be that way again. And I think talking to you about what I did and confessing it, if that's even the right word, will help me to prevent something like that from happening again. Now that I have, and now that I have told you everything else, I'm finished. Father David stares at his desk. I stare at him. I wait for him to speak, but he doesn't. He just stares. I stand. Thank you for listening to me. I walk toward the door. As I reach for the knob, I hear him speak. James. I turn around. I'm sorry. You didn't do anything. I'm sorry anyway. Thank you. And thank you again for listening to me. I open the door and I step into the hall, and I close the door behind me. I take a deep breath and I let it out slowly. As it leaves me, so does everything I wrote, everything I said, everything I have done. It's gone. All of it. It's fucking gone. I walk back to the unit. My step is light and easy. I have a smile on my face. I go to my room and there is a note on my door that says, "Call your brother at work." Beneath the writing, there is a number. I take the note and I walk to the phone booth, and I step inside and I shut the door. I dial the number, wait while it rings. A woman answers. I ask for Bob Fry. She says, "Just a moment, please." My brother picks up and he says, "Hello." I say, "What's up, motherfucker?" And he laughs, and he says, "Congratulations, you're getting out." I say, "Thank you," and I ask him if he can pick me up, and he says, "Yes, he's taking a few days off, and he's hoping that I'll stay with him." I tell him, "That sounds good." He tells me my friend Kevin wants to come up from Chicago to see me, and he asks if that would be okay. I tell him it would be great, and he says he'll call him. He asks me what time he should come, and I say 10:30 or 11 or whenever he can get here. He says he'll see me at 10:30. We hang up. The men are leaving for lunch, and I follow them. As I walk toward my room, I see Miles stepping out of it. He turns to me and smiles. "Hello, James." He shuts the door, starts walking with me. "Hello, Miles. How you been?" "Busy." "With what?" "My wife is coming tomorrow, doing all of the things we're expected to do here, and I've been trying to help Ted." "What's up with Ted?" "Ted is looking at life no parole in Louisiana. I have been trying to help him avoid it." "Any luck?" "No, I'm afraid I can't help him. The girl's father wants him put away." "Fuck. Does he know?" "Yes." "What's he say?" "He wants to stay here for as long as he can, and then he thinks he can hide with relatives in Mississippi."
"What do you think about that?"
"I think it is very sad." We enter the corridor between the men and women. Miles nudges me, and he motions toward the women's section. I look over, and I see Lily. Her back is to me, and she is sitting at a table with three other women. Her hair is in a ponytail, and she is wearing a T-shirt. Her arms look too thin, as if she has lost a lot of weight. I smile. I see one of the women say my name, and I wait for Lily to turn around. I hope she will turn around, but she doesn't. One of the women sitting at her table is the supervisor of her unit. As I get in line, I stare at her. As I get my food, which is a turkey pot pie, I stare at her. As I walk through the dining room toward the table in the corner, I stare at her. I want her to turn around. I want to see her face. She doesn't. I sit down. Miles sits with me. We are joined by Ted and Maddie and Michael. Neither Ted nor Maddie speak a word. They just stare at their plates and eat. Miles and Michael talk about their children. I stare at Lily's long black hair and her arms that look too thin. When she stands to take her tray to the conveyor, I stand as well. I walk slowly and I try to time my arrival so that it coincides with her arrival. I know if I speak to her or try to get her to acknowledge me, I will get her in trouble, so I'm not going to try. I just want to be near her. Near enough to feel her presence. Near enough to see the details of her face. Near enough to smell the scent of her hair. I just want to be near her. She arrives at the conveyor and she places her tray on it. The other women are behind her and I am behind them. When she turns around, she sees me and she smiles. It is a wide smile, a beautiful smile. I have missed that smile. I have missed it. I smile back, though what I want to do is put my arms around her and hold her and kiss her and tell her I love her. That's all I want to do. Put my arms around her and hold her and kiss her and tell her I love her. The other women place their trays on the conveyor and they turn around and they walk away and Lily walks away with them. I place my tray on the conveyor and I follow them down the glass corridor and into the halls. At the entrance to the lecture hall, they turn and they go inside. I walk past to Joanne's office. The door is open when I arrive. I walk inside and Ken and Joanne are sitting on the couch. They are each looking at files that are sitting on their laps. I sit in the chair opposite them and I wait for them to finish. Joanne looks up. We were just going over your post-treatment plan. How's it look? Ken speaks.
If you follow it, it will serve you very well.
Joanne closes her file, sits up. Ken closes his file, and he hands it to me. I take it, and I open it, and I look at it. It is filled with AA literature and schedules of AA meetings in Chicago. I close it.
Looks good.
Joanne speaks. You should take a little more time to look at it.
Why?
There's more in there than you think there is.
All I saw were things related to AA.
Ken speaks.
That's because we're recommending that you attend AA.
I look at Joanne. I thought we were through with this bullshit.
Ken wanted to go over it again, and I agreed that we should.
Why?
Ken speaks. Because you won't stay sober without AA.
Why do you think that?
Because it is the only thing that works.
It might be the only thing that works for you, but it won't work for me.
Why?
I don't believe in the 12 steps. I don't believe in God or any form of higher power. I refuse to turn my life and my will over to anything or anyone, much less something I don't believe in.
Then what are you going to do?
I'm going to live my life. I am going to take things as they come, and I will deal with what is in front of me when it is in front of me. When alcohol or drugs or both are in front of me, I will make a decision not to use them. I'm not going to live in fear of alcohol or drugs, and I'm not going to spend my time sitting and talking with people who live in fear of them. I am not going to be dependent on anything but myself.
Ken shakes his head.
That's a recipe for disaster. I laugh at him. I guess we'll see. Joanne speaks.
I've said this before, James, and though I've been impressed by the way you've come to terms with your addictions and your life, I feel it is my responsibility to say it again.
What?
The odds of someone with your substance abuse history staying sober without tremendous amounts of support, both in AA and therapy, be it individual therapy or group therapy, are 1 to 1. 1 to 1 at best. Those odds don't scare me. Ken speaks.
1 to 1, James.
It's 1 to 1 that I'm here right now. 1 to 1 doesn't scare me. Joanne speaks.
I think it would make Ken and me feel better if you'd at least go over what's in the file with us.
Okay. I open my copy of the file. They open their copies. And we start going over it. It has a small book on recovery in jail, which is about AA programs in correctional facilities and working the steps while incarcerated. It has a schedule of AA meetings in Chicago and a list of phone numbers of the groups. It has a small packet of literature on rational reaction therapy and how to apply it in the outside world. It has a packet of information on a facility in Chicago related to this clinic and the programs they offer for people who have been through treatment. It has a copy of the 12 steps themselves. It has a copy of the Serenity Prayer. As we go over all of it, Ken and Joanne dutifully explain everything, and I dutifully listen to them. I figure I owe them the respect of listening to them. When we are finished, I am relieved. If all goes as I hope, and I plan, and I expect it to go, I will never have to listen to anything having to do with my own involvement with Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps ever again. I close my file. I ask Joanne if she minds if I smoke, and she laughs and says she was about to ask me the same thing. We both light up. Ken stands and says he's going to go, and I stand, and I thank him for all of his time and all of his effort. And I shake his hand, and he wishes me luck. And he tells me to call him if I ever have questions or concerns, and I thank him again, and he leaves. I sit back down, and Joanne speaks.
You feeling good?
Yeah.
Excited?
Yeah.
You get hold of your brother?
He's coming to pick me up in the morning. I think a friend of mine will be with him.
What are you gonna do?
Get a fucking cheeseburger. She laughs.
If you had told me you wanted one, I would have brought one for you.
You've done enough for me.
Will you come say goodbye in the morning?
Absolutely.
Good.
I put out my smoke and I stand, and I thank Joanne, and she says, don't worry about it, and I leave her office. I walk back through the halls and I go to my room, and I start gathering my things, though there is little to gather. A couple of pairs of pants, a couple of T-shirts, a sweater and a pair of slippers and a pair of shoes, 3 books and a lighter. It isn't much, but it is mine, and it is all that I need. As I finish packing it into a small plastic bag, Miles walks into the room. He is carrying a brown manila envelope.
There was something in the mail for you.
He hands me the envelope. I sit down on my bed.
Thank you.
As Miles unpacks and assembles his clarinet, I stare at the envelope. It is plain and brown. There is no return address, and the postmark is from San Francisco. It is addressed to me here at the clinic. The handwriting is simple and legible. The letters wide and loose and loopy. It looks like the handwriting of a woman. I think about women I know who live in San Francisco. There is only one, and she wouldn't speak to me, much less write me a letter. I open the envelope. I open it carefully along the ridge where it had been sealed before mailing. It tears slowly, and when I have it open, I reach inside. I feel a small stack of photographs. They are held together by a rubber band. I take them out of the envelope. The first photo in the stack is a black-and-white photo of her. Her with blonde hair like thick ropes of silk. Her with blue eyes like the ice of the Arctic. She is standing in her room, the room where we first met, and she is smiling, and she is holding a stuffed animal. I know this photo, and I used to have a copy of it. I used to carry the copy around with me in my wallet. I carried it before we were together. I carried it when we were together. I carried it after we were apart. She is holding the animal, some kind of stuffed lion, in front of her chest. Her hair is down. She is not wearing makeup, and her smile is open and wide, as if the camera's shutter snapped just before she started laughing. She is beautiful in the picture, absolutely beautiful.
I start looking through the rest of the pictures. There is one of us walking down a street together. We are holding hands and smiling. There is one of us lying together on a couch. I am asleep and she is kissing my cheek. There is one of us dressed in fancy clothes. Her in a dress, me in a borrowed suit. We're toasting with glasses of champagne. There is one of us sitting in the sun under a fading fall tree. She is holding a book. I am smoking a cigarette. There is one of us kissing. Our eyes are closed. Our arms are wrapped around each other. Our lips have barely softly met. Her and me, we're kissing. I put the photos back in a stack. I place the rubber band around them. I put them back into the envelope and I close the envelope. I stand and I walk out of the room. I go into the unit down the stairs, out the door. I start walking along the trail that leads to the woods. It is cold, and night is falling, and I am not wearing a jacket. My teeth start chattering and my body starts shaking. I enter the woods. I walk along the trail until it leads me to the point where I break off toward the clearing. I push my way through the dense branches, the dense evergreen, the dense undergrowth. I push my way into the clear. I sit on the ground. The dirt is cold, the dead leaves frozen and stiff. I take the stack of 22 yellow pages I have been carrying around with me out of my pocket. I read them. I read them slowly. I read every word, relive every memory. I set them on the ground. I take the photos from the envelope, and I take the rubber band from around them, and I look at them. I look at them slowly. I look at every photo. I relive every memory. I set them, with the envelope, on top of the stack of yellow paper. I take my lighter from my pocket. I draw my thumb along its flint. The lighter ignites, and a small blue flame emerges from its tip. I put the flame beneath the yellow paper. I hold it there until the paper accepts it. The paper catches on its edge and the flame starts spreading. I put the lighter back in my pocket. I sit and I stare at the pile as it burns. I sit and I stare as the yellow turns red with fire, turns black with ash, turns from ash to smoke and disappears. I watch the photographs catch and bend and crinkle and disintegrate. I watch her captured image disintegrate. I watch the times we had together burn away. I watch my memories of her burn away. I am through with them. Fucking through. It is time to say goodbye. When everything has been burned, I stand and I put my foot on the pile of smoldering ash, and I rub it into the dirt. I rub it until nothing remains of it, and there is no sign of the fire. I rub it until it mixes with the earth and it is black. And it is gone. Night has come, and with it the darkness and the cold. I push my way back through dense branches, dense evergreen, dense undergrowth. I meet the trail, and I follow it through the woods. I cross frozen grass, and I walk toward the lights of the clinic. I arrive at the door, and I go inside. The unit is empty. I glance at a clock on the wall. It is time for dinner. I leave the unit and I walk through the halls toward the dining hall. I am not hungry, and if I can, I will not eat another meal here, but I want to see Lily. I walk through the corridor. I look directly into the women's section. I scan the tables for her, but she isn't there. I look closer. She isn't there. I look at the table where her unit supervisor is sitting, but she isn't there. As I turn toward the stack of trays, I see her walking toward me. She smiles and she brushes her hair away from her eyes. There are black circles beneath them, but the deep water blue is shining. I stop where I am and I wait for her, and as she passes, without saying a word, she gently brushes her hand across the skin of my forearm. I turn and I watch her walk away. She does not look back at me. When she is gone, I glance toward her supervisor, who sees my glance and frowns at me and shakes her head as if to say, "I saw what just happened. Don't do it again." I smile and I walk away. I get a cup of coffee and I look for my friends. They are walking toward me and they are carrying their trays.
Maddie and Ted both look miserable. They grunt hello as they pass by me. Miles and Michael are just behind them. I turn, and I walk with them to the conveyor. Miles speaks.
You're a little late.
I was busy. Michael speaks. Probably best.
Why?
It was a very depressing dinner.
What happened?
Miles speaks. Ted found out he has to leave here in 3 days, and Maddie's wife is missing.
Fuck.
Michael speaks.
It was very depressing.
Fuck. They put their trays away. We walk through the halls. They go to the lecture, and I go back to my room. I sit down on my bed, and I get my copy of the Tao, and I climb under the covers, and I start reading. 79. Failure is an opportunity. If you blame someone else, you will never stop blaming. Fulfill your own obligations. Correct your own mistakes. Do what you need to do and demand nothing of others. 64. What is rooted will grow. What is recent can be fixed. What is brittle will break. Prevent trouble before it finds you. Put things in order before they exist. The giant tree grows from a single seed. The journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. If you rush, you'll fail. Hold on to things too tight and you'll lose them. Take action by letting action come to you. Remain as calm at the start as at the finish. If you have nothing, you have nothing to lose. Desire to not desire. Learn to unlearn. Care for nothing, and you will care for everything. The words are as true now as the first time I read them. They don't tell me what to do or how to live or what not to do or how not to live. They simply tell me to be what I am and who I am and let life exist and exist within life. The words are true. 22. If you want to be whole, you must first be partial. If you want to be straight, you must first be crooked. If you want to be full, first become empty. If you want to be reborn, you must first die. If you want everything, give everything up. If you don't display yourself, people will see your light. If you have nothing to prove, people will trust you. If you don't try to be something, people will see themselves in you. If you don't have a goal, you will always succeed. 41. When a superior man hears of the Tao, he begins to embody it. When an average man hears of the Tao, he believes in parts of it, and he doubts in parts of it. When a fool hears of the Tao, he laughs at it. If he didn't laugh, it wouldn't be the Tao. It is said that the path into light is dark, that the path forward is backward, that true power seems weak, that true purity seems tarnished, that true resolve seems changeable, that true clarity seems obscure. The greatest art is unsophisticated, the greatest love indifferent, the greatest wisdom childish. Miles walks into the room. I close the book. He walks to his bed, and he picks up his clarinet, and he asks me if I mind if he plays it. I say, please, I'd like it if you played. He picks it up, licks his lips, puts the reed to his mouth, and he blows. I close my eyes. I hear long and slow. I hear short and fast. I hear a song that doesn't come from notes on a page, but from a beating human heart. I hear sorrow and shame and hope and redemption. I hear a past that doesn't matter, and the future that never comes. I hear harmony and simplicity and patience. I hear discipline and compassion. I hear it all now, in this moment, in this clinic, in this room, in this bed, with my eyes closed. I hear it, right now. The clock on Miles's nightstand reads 3:47. I am wide awake. It feels as if there's a phantom in the room, a phantom that wants to kill me. Slowly and painfully kill me. I sit up. I look around the room. It is dark, but I can see. Miles is asleep in his bed. The door is shut. The window is closed. Everything is as it was when I fell asleep. Though I know there is not, it still feels as if there's something in the room. I get out of bed. I walk to the bathroom. I splash cold water on my face. I do it again and again. It doesn't make a difference. I still feel the phantom. I walk out of the bathroom and I put on my clothes. I get Hank's jacket, a pack of cigarettes, my lighter. I leave. I walk through the unit. It is quiet, and still everyone is sleeping. I go outside. I feel as if something is following me. I walk to the benches in front of the lake. I sit down on the middle bench. I light a cigarette and I stare at the frozen water. It is silent and black, unmoving. There are sticks and leaves trapped within it. Solitary bats dive along its surface. The phantom starts to take shape. It reveals itself as fear. I don't fight it or even try. I don't think I could fight it if I wanted to fight it. I am scared. I don't know what I am scared of. I am just scared. As I sit and I smoke and I stare at the lake, my fear starts to form itself. I am scared. I am scared of leaving here. I am scared of losing the protection and security that exists within these boundaries. I am scared of going to jail. I am scared of what is going to happen to me there. I am scared of alcohol and drugs, and I am scared of drinking alcohol and using drugs. I am scared of what might happen if I do. I am scared of what might happen if I don't. I am scared, scared, scared. I am scared of everything. I am scared of sex, of a job, of money, of having a place to live. I am scared of the thought of having these things. I am scared of the thought of not having them. I am scared of Lily. I am scared of loving her, and I am scared of letting her love me. I am scared of having her. I am scared of losing her. I am scared of living with her. I am scared of living without her. I am scared of having my heart broken. I am scared by her fragility and dependence. I'm scared of living. I'm scared of dying. I'm scared of living. I'm scared. I sit and I stare at the lake. I smoke. I watch the sky turn gray. There is no sun. I ask a bank of thick gray clouds what to do. I ask a bat what to do. I ask the grass, the ice, a frozen stick, a dead worm, the benches, each of the benches. What do I do? Fear is only fear. I already know that nothing can hurt me more than I have already hurt myself. I know there is no pain that I cannot endure. I know that by holding on each moment, each hour, each day, the days add up, each week, each month. If I hold on, I will be fine. I know I am strong. I know I am strong enough to confront what I fear, and I know I am strong enough to hold on until the fear goes away. I believe this in my heart. I laugh. I laugh out loud. The answers to my questions are simple if I allow them to be simple. They are all in my lap. I just need to look down. I am scared of everything. I am scared because I allow myself to be scared. There is nothing that should scare me. I laugh out loud because it is so simple. I shouldn't be scared of anything. I am not scared of anything. Simple as that. Not one fucking thing. I stand and I walk back to the unit. I open the door and I go inside. The men are awake now. They are doing their morning jobs, reading the newspaper, drinking coffee, and smoking cigarettes. I go over to the shelves and I tear a piece of yellow paper off one of the pads and I take a pen from the mug. I put them in my pocket and I go to my room. Miles is standing by his bed. He turns around and he looks at me. Hello, James. Hi. Are you excited to be leaving? I smile. I am. Are you excited to see your wife? I am very excited. I hope it all works out for the two of you. I have a feeling that it is going to. I smile again. Good. I pull the pen and paper from my pocket. I was wondering if I could get your address and phone number.
If I can have yours.
I don't really have either one.
When you get them, will you give them to me?
Of course, but you'll hear from me before that.
I would hope so.
He takes the pen and the paper, and he sits down on his bed. He puts the paper on his lap and he writes down his information. He stands and he hands the paper and the pen back to me. He speaks.
It has been an honor getting to know you, James. I appreciate everything you have given me. I'll always wish you the best, and I'll always be there if you ever need help with anything.
That might be the first time anyone has ever said it was an honor getting to know me.
He laughs.
Thanks for all your help, Miles.
Whether you admit it or not, I know you helped me in Ohio, and I'll always owe you for that. He smiles.
You've been a great friend, and I'll miss you.
He nods again.
You too, James.
He reaches out his hand, and I take it, and we shake hands. We release each other's hands, and we hug each other. We hold each other for a moment, and Miles says, "Good luck, James." And I say, "You too, Miles."
You ready for breakfast?
I nod.
Yeah.
We walk out. We walk through the halls, and we walk into the glass corridor separating men and women. I look for Lily, and she isn't there. We walk through the corridor, and Miles gets a tray and a plate of eggs and cheese, and I get a cup of coffee. We walk over to our table, the table where we sit for every meal, the table in the corner. I sit, and I drink my coffee, and I look for Lily. Miles eats his eggs and cheese. Ted and Maddie and Michael join us, and I ask them for their addresses and their phone numbers. Michael gives me both. Maddie gives me his address, but no phone number. Ted doesn't have either one of them. I ask Maddie to sign the bottom of the paper, and he asks me why. I tell him I want his autograph, and he laughs, and he says it ain't worth shit no more. I tell him I want it because it is worth something to me. He smiles, and he writes, "To James, the goddamn middleweight champion of the fucking drug center. I hope we live long enough to see each other again. That would be fucking nice. Your friend, Matty Jackson, former undisputed featherweight champion of the world." I take the paper and I put it in my pocket. When I am sure it is deep and safe within, I take a sip of my coffee. I take a sip and I wait. I take a sip and I wait. I see Lily walk through the corridor. She is with her unit supervisor and she does not look over at me. I watch her as she gets in line, gets a tray, gets a cup of coffee, and gets a donut. I watch her as she walks into the women's section and she sits down at a table. I watch as her unit supervisor makes Lily sit so that her back is facing toward me. I stand. I say goodbye to my friends. They ask me if they are going to see me again, and I tell them only if it's on the outside. I hug each of them. I thank them for their friendship, and I wish them luck, and I tell them that I hope everything works out for them. I pick up my cup and I put it on the conveyor. I stand and I watch as it is carried away to cleanliness. It is the last coffee mug I will use here. I say goodbye to it. I turn and I start walking down the corridor. My eyes are on Lily, even though she can't see me. About halfway down the corridor, I stop walking and I turn. And I stand in front of the glass and I stare. Lily's table is about 30 feet away. There are 4 or 5 other tables between me and it. There are about 30 tables in the women's dining room. All of them are filled. I stand and I stare. I stand and I stare. At the back of Lily's head. At her long, beautiful black hair. At her hand as it brings her donut to her mouth. A woman a couple of tables away from her motions toward me. And the rest of the women at that table turn and look at me. One of them says something to a woman at the next table, and all of the women at that table turn and look at me. One of those women says something to Lily's unit supervisor, who looks up and glares at me. I don't move. I'm not going to move. I stare at Lily's beautiful hair and beautiful hand. I smile because she's eating a donut, and I think it's funny. The unit supervisor motions for me to leave, but I am not moving. No fucking way. Lily sees her supervisor glaring at me and motioning at me, and she turns around and she sees me. She smiles. I stare at her beautiful face, at her beautiful blood-red lips, at her beautiful skin so pale, at her deep-water eyes, those
beautiful blue, deep water eyes. She is all that I see. Beautiful Lily, she is all that I see. Beautiful Lily.
She turns away. I see her supervisor mouthing words, but I can't see what she is saying. I see Lily's jaw move. She's saying something back. The supervisor speaks again. I can't see the words, but I can see her face. She's angry, and her anger is rising. I see Lily say something back to her. I see Lily stand and push her chair away. I see Lily turn and start walking toward the entrance to the corridor. I see her supervisor stand and yell something at her. I see Lily ignore her and keep walking toward the entrance to the corridor. I turn to her as she comes around the corner of the glass. I smile at her as she walks toward me. I start walking toward her. My heart is beating, beating, beating. I'm smiling, and she's smiling. She starts walking faster toward me. She's beautiful, so beautiful, inside and out. I love her. Coming toward me, I love her. I open my arms. She runs into them, into me. I close them around her, close them tight, hold her tight as I can hold her. She closes her arms around me. There are no words. There is no noise. There is no one around us. I can feel her heart beating against my chest. I know she can feel my heart beating against her chest. Nothing else matters. Nothing else exists. Just her and me. Her heart and my heart. Her heart and my heart. I kiss her neck, smell her hair, hold her body. She's so small and thin. I hold her body. I can feel her crying on my shoulder, silently weeping, her tears on her cheek, her tears on my shirt. I whisper, I love you, I love you, I love you. I whisper, I love you, into her ear. She pushes herself away, but not out of my arms. She pushes herself away so that I can see her face and she can see mine. She is smiling, and there are tears streaming down her cheeks. Her lower lip is shaking, and her eyes are more blue with the wetness contained. I smile at her. I speak. I love you, Lily.
I love you, James.
I'm going to miss you.
Where are you going?
I'm leaving in a little while.
Where?
I have to go to jail in Ohio.
No.
It's only for a few months. I'm going to write you every day, and I'll call you whenever I can.
No!
You'll hear from me every day. In some form, you'll hear from me. When I'm done, I'm coming to Chicago.
I'm going to be alone.
No, you're not.
I am.
You're not.
You promise?
Remember the word?
What word?
Ever? She smiles.
I like it, that word.
Remember it.
I'll miss you. I'm going to worry about you.
Worry about getting better. I'll be fine, and I'll come to you as soon as I can.
I love you, James.
I love you, Lily. I love you. She leans toward me, and she closes her eyes. I close my eyes, and I let her come. Our lips meet, softly, gently, slowly our lips meet, and our arms are tight around each other, and everything is good and safe and getting better. In each other's arms, everything is good and safe. Everything is getting better. Our lips separate. Our eyes open. I stare into deep water blue. She stares into pale green. I reach up with one hand and draw it down her cheek. As it slides off, I step back. Deep water blue into pale green. I smile. I turn around and I start walking away. As I walk down the glass corridor that will lead me out of here, I know Lily is standing in the space where I left her, and I know she is waiting for me to turn around and say goodbye. I know if I do, my heart will break. I know if I do, I'll start crying. I know if I do, it will be something I have never done before. Turn around and say goodbye. The glass ends and the halls start. I stop, and I turn around, and I look at Lily. She is smiling, and there are tears rolling down her cheeks. I say, I love you, and though I know she can't hear me, I know she understands. She is smiling and crying. I lift one hand. I hold it in front of my chest and I say goodbye. She nods. I close my hand into a fist, and I say, get better. She nods. I stand and I stare at her and I smile. She stands and stares at me and she cries. I can see her eyes from here. I am going to miss those eyes. Deep water blue. I am going to miss those eyes. I turn around and I walk away, and the light of the glass hall fades, though the image of Lily does not. I will hold that image of Lily, beautiful Lily, standing alone and smiling and crying in my heart and in my mind for the rest of my life. Dearest Lily. I walk through the halls and I go to my room. I get Hank's jacket and the small black bag that holds my belongings. I leave the room and I walk to Joanne's office. I knock on the door. She says, come in. I open the door and I step inside. Joanne and Hank are sitting together on her couch. They are drinking coffee and Joanne is smoking a cigarette. Joanne smiles and she speaks. Hi. I walk to the chair opposite them. Hi. I sit. Hank speaks. We've been waiting for you. I had breakfast. Joanne speaks. How was it? It was beautiful. She smiles. I've never heard anyone describe a meal here as beautiful. I smile. That's what it was. Beautiful. Hank speaks. You ready to go? Yeah. You scared? I was earlier, but I'm not now. Joanne speaks. What were you scared of? Everything. And what happened? I decided not to be. Simple as that? Simple as that. I hold up Hank's jacket, toss it to him. I brought your jacket back. Thank you for letting me use it. He tosses it back to me. I want you to keep it. I toss it back to him. Thank you, but no. I want you to keep it so when I come back to visit, I'll be able to wear it. I'll make that deal on one condition.
What's that?
You come back here sober, as a visitor, not as a patient. Have no doubt about that, old man. He smiles. That's my motherfucking boy. Joanne speaks. Watch your mouth, Hank. Hank turns to her. I can swear around him now. He ain't a patient anymore.
He's a patient until he walks out the front door.
Hank turns to me. You care if I say motherfucking around you? I smile. I'd be fucking offended if you didn't. Hank laughs, slaps his knee. That's my motherfucking boy. I laugh. Joanne speaks. You're all set to be picked up?
Yeah.
Have you checked out yet?
No.
You should get going. I nod again.
I know.
She stands.
Give me a hug?
I stand.
Of course.
I step forward and I hug her. There is emotion in the hug and there is respect and a form of love. Emotion that comes from honesty, respect that comes from challenge, and the form of love that exists between people whose minds have touched, whose hearts have touched, whose souls have touched. Our minds touched, our hearts touched, our souls touched. We separate. Hank steps forward. I ain't much for words, kid. He puts his arms around me and he hugs me so hard that it hurts. My arms are pinned to my sides so I can't hug him, but I don't think he needs it. He lets go of me and he takes a step back and he puts one of his arms around Joanne's shoulders. He speaks.
Make us proud, kid.
I'll try.
Do better than try. I want you back here wearing that fucking coat in a year.
Joanne speaks.
Hank.
Hank looks at her. He's not a patient anymore. Joanne shakes her head, turns to me.
Stay in touch.
I nod.
I will.
I turn and I walk out of the office. I close the door behind me and I walk through the halls. I go to the administration office and I sit with an administration officer and I fill out my release papers. When I am finished, I sign my name on the bottom of a page and I am done. The officer tells me I am free to go.
I walk out of the office and through a short hall. I walk into the lobby where I sat waiting with my family in a different life. I say hello to the receptionist, and she says hello to me. Through the windows, I see my brother's gray truck, which is the type of fancy passenger truck common in the suburbs, sitting in front of the entrance. I open the front door, and I walk out of the clinic. I am free to go. My brother sees me coming, and he opens the driver's door, and he steps out of his truck. He is smiling. He speaks. "What's up, buddy? What's up, motherfucker?" He hugs me. I hug him. A good, strong, fraternal hug. My friend Kevin steps out of the passenger's door. He is my size, has short, dark, parted hair, and a newly grown beer belly. He sells commercial real estate for a living, but when he is not working, he dresses like a bum. He smiles and he speaks. "What's up?" "Nothing. What's up with you?" "Came to make sure you're okay." I smile. "I am." He hugs me. I hug him. My brother speaks. "You ready to go?" "Yeah, let's get out of here." I pick up my bag, and I open the door, and I climb into the back seat. As I close the door, Bob and Kevin get in the front seats, and Bob starts the car, and we pull away. I turn around, and I watch the clinic recede into the distance from the back window. I am free to go. Free to go. Free. When I can no longer see the buildings, I turn around. Almost immediately, the fury starts to rise, as if the walls of the clinic kept it in check, as if my freedom is its freedom, as if my walking papers were its walking papers. The ascension is fast and brutal, and though I'm not shaking on the outside, I am shaking on the inside. Kevin turns, and he looks at me, and he speaks. "How's it feel?" I see Bob looking at me in the rearview mirror. "I don't know." Bob speaks. "What's that mean?" "I don't know." Kevin speaks. "What do you want to do?" "I want to go to a bar." "What?" "I want to go to a bar." "You fucking kidding me?" "No, I'm not." My brother Bob is looking at me in the rearview mirror. Kevin looks at Bob. Bob looks at Kevin. There is concern, dismay, and shock on both of their faces. Bob looks back at me, shakes his head. "We're not going to a bar." "You might not be, but I am." "You just got out of rehab." "I'm going to a bar."
"You just got out of fucking rehab."
"I am going to a bar. You can come with me or not. Either way is fine. And you shouldn't waste your time trying to stop me. I'm going to a fucking bar." Bob looks at Kevin. Kevin at Bob. Kevin shrugs. Bob shakes his head. I light a cigarette and roll down the window. Even though it is cold, I like the air. It is free. The drive takes an hour. No one speaks. Bob stares out the front window. Kevin stares out the front passenger's window. I stare out my window. Occasionally, I stick my head out and let the freezing air whip against the skin of my face. It hurts, but it feels good, and I do it because I can. I no longer have rules and regulations I have to follow. I no longer have counselors and supervisors and psychologists demanding answers. My schedule and my actions are once again my own, as it was before I went to the clinic, and as it will be until the end. I answer only to myself. We pull off the highway and into the city. I look at the clock on Bob's dashboard. It reads 11:30. I ask him if he knows somewhere that is open now, and he says yes. I tell him I prefer a place that serves cheeseburgers and has a pool table. He does not respond. He just stares out of the front window. The fury has risen. It is at full strength. It is beyond full strength. It is different now, at this moment. It feels different. It feels stronger, quieter, more patient, simpler and more powerful, as if it is secure in its victory over me, as if the fight with me has fortified its might, as if it knows its time has come again, as if it is waiting to unleash itself. I don't fight it. I don't challenge it. I sit and I wait, and I anticipate my arrival in a place that feels like home. I sit and I wait, and I save myself for what is to come when I step inside a bar. The fury is stronger than it has ever been before. I sit and I wait for what is to come. Bob pulls into a small parking lot.
Next to the parking lot is a large brick building. There are tall, dark windows along the front of the building. There is a neon sign that reads Billiards, Bar, and Grill. We get out of the truck. I don't have any money, so I ask Bob if I can borrow some. He asks me how much I need, and I ask him for $40. He asks me why I need so much, and I tell him because I do. He takes his wallet out of his pocket, and he opens it, and he gives me $2.20s. I thank him. We walk through the parking lot. We walk along a short stretch of sidewalk. We come to the front door, and I reach for it, and I open it. I motion Bob and Kevin through, and after they have gone through, I follow them inside. It is dark. There are tables in front of us. A long, worn oak bar runs the length of the wall to our right. At the end of the bar, and to the left, is a room with 6 pool tables. Next to the pool tables, a bored waitress sits at her station watching a television that hangs from the ceiling. Behind the bar, a bartender sits on a stool reading a newspaper. Neither of them look up. I look at Bob and Kevin. I speak. Why don't you guys go shoot some pool? My brother looks at me. What are you going to do? I need a couple of minutes alone. His face is full with fear and disappointment. It is none of my concern. It is time for the reckoning. It is time for the fury. I turn and I walk to the bar. I pull out a stool about halfway down its length and I sit down. There are mirrors and bottles in front of me. The mirrors run from the ceiling down to a set of shelves. The shelves are lined with bottles. There are whiskey bottles, vodka bottles, bottles of gin. There are rum bottles, tequila bottles, bottles of strange liqueurs from foreign countries. There are clear bottles and brown bottles. There are red bottles and blue bottles. There are multicolored bottles designed to please the eye. Some of the bottles are short, some are tall, some are wide, some are thin. They are all filled with alcohol. They are sitting in front of me. They are filled with fucking alcohol. I look toward the bartender. I speak. Barkeep. He looks up. Yeah? Give me a little help? Sure. He sets down his paper and he walks toward me. When he is standing in front of me, he speaks. How you doing today? I'm not here to talk. You in a bad mood? I'm not here to talk. What can I get you? I look at the bottles, the beautiful bottles filled with alcohol. I let my eyes wander until they settle, avoiding the mirrors, avoiding myself. I stare at a black bottle, a thick black bottle with a thin neck that is filled with Kentucky bourbon. It is the bottle the Fury most craves, the bottle with which it is most familiar. I point to it, stare at the bartender, and I speak. I want a glass of that. I want a big glass. Not one of those bullshit cocktail glasses, but a big fucking pint glass. I want it filled to the top. That's gonna be expensive. I set the $40 my brother gave me on the surface of the bar. Just bring it. The bartender stares at me like I'm crazy, like he's debating whether he is going to give me what I want. I stare back, let him know that I'm not leaving until I have it. He turns around. With one hand, he reaches for a tall, thin pint glass, and with the other, he takes the black bottle from the shelf. I watch him pour the drink. As if in slow motion, I see every drop. When the glass is full, he turns around and he sets it in front of me. Thank you. I'll be down there if you need anything else. Thank you. He walks back to his newspaper. I stare at the glass. The fury rises from its silent state. It screams bloody fucking murder. It is stronger than it has ever been before. It screams, "You are mine, motherfucker. You are mine and you will always be mine. I own you. I control you and you will do what I tell you to do. You are mine and you will always be mine. You are mine, motherfucker." I stare at the glass. I put my hands on the bar. I put them on either side of the glass. They are not touching it, but they are close. Close enough so that when I decide, the glass will be within easy reach. I lean down. As my nose moves toward the strong brown alcohol, I can smell the fumes drifting from its shimmering surface. They enrage me. They make the fury scream louder. They taunt me. They draw me closer. I close my eyes. I stop moving when the tip of my nose hits the liquid. I close my mouth, and I take a deep breath, and it comes, 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 with all of its strength, the beautiful aroma of oblivion, the foul stench of hell. It makes me shudder, shakes me. Inside and out, it destroys me and fortifies me. Though it has not met my lips or entered my body, I can taste it. Like sweet, strong charcoal mixed with bitter gasoline, I can fucking taste it. Time stops. I do not move. I sit with the tip of my nose in a glass filled with alcohol. I breathe deep, thorough breaths, all the way in, all the way out. It ebbs when I inhale, ripples when I exhale. I can smell it, and I can taste it, and I can feel it, inside and out. The fury screams, pick it up, pick it up, pick it up. The fury screams, drink it, drink it, drink it. The fury screams, more, 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 more. The fury screams, want, need, have to have, can't live without, I own you, motherfucker, pick it up, drink it, give it to me, or I will make you pay, more, 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 more. I open my eyes. I see the clear amber brown, the tip of my nose submerged, the rim of my glass. I start to slowly lift my head. I keep my eyes straight ahead, fixed and focused. They will not blink. The liquid disappears from view. The rim of the glass disappears. I see shelves and bottles, the edge of the mirror. I keep moving up. I see the edge of my chin, my lips, my nose. I keep moving up. I see the edge of my eye, the lash, the white surrounding. I keep moving up. I see pale green, straight ahead, fixed and focused. They will not blink. I look into myself, into my own eyes. There is a glass of alcohol in front of me. Though I can no longer see it, I know it is there. I put my hands around it. My hands are on the glass. I look into myself, into the pale green of my own eyes. The fury is screaming, screaming like it has never screamed before. Its scream is stronger and more powerful, full of rage and need, of hostility and hunger. It is screaming for me to pick up the glass. Pick up the fucking glass. I have a decision to make. It is a simple decision. It has nothing to do with God or 12 of anything other than 12 beats of my heart. Yes or no. It is a simple decision. Yes or no. I look into myself, into the pale green of my own eyes. I like what I see. I am comfortable with it. It is fixed and focused. It will not blink. For the first time in my life, as I look into my own eyes, I like what I see. I can live with it. I want to live with it. For a long time, I want to live with it. I want to live. The fury screams bloody fucking murder. The pale green softly speaks. It says, you are mine, motherfucker, you are mine, and you will always be mine. From this day forward, I own you, I control you, and you will do what I tell you to do. From this day forward, I make the fucking decisions. You are mine, and you will always be mine. You are mine, motherfucker.
I let go of the glass. I look at the bartender. He is sitting on his stool, and he is reading his newspaper. I speak. Barkeep? He looks up. Yeah? Dump this shit out for me.
What?
I motion to the glass. Dump this shit down the fucking drain. I don't want it. He stares at me for a moment like I'm crazy. I stare back and let him know I'm not. He stands and he starts walking toward me. I stand and I walk away. I leave the glass in the bar and the 220s next to it. I walk into the room with the pool tables. My brother Bob and my friend Kevin are finishing a game. There is one solid ball on the table, one striped ball, and the eight ball in a corner. I sit down on a stool along the wall. There is a table next to the stool and an ashtray on the table. I light a cigarette. As my brother lines up a shot, he sees me sitting in the corner of his eye. He looks up and he speaks. You all right?
Yeah.
What were you doing over there?
Nothing.
Did you drink?
No.
Why'd you order one?
It was something I needed to do.
But you didn't touch it?
I touched it, and I smelled it, and I felt it, but I didn't drink it. I'm done drinking. Won't ever do it again. He smiles. Congratulations, buddy. I smile.
Thanks.
As my brother lines up his shot, I ask if I can play the winner. Kevin asks me how long it's been since I played, and I tell him it's been a long time. He asks me if I'm ready, and I smile, and I tell him that I am. He asks me again. He wants to make sure. I tell him, yes, I'm ready. Yes, I'm ready. Michael returned to work at the university. 3 weeks later, he was arrested for solicitation of prostitution and possession of crack cocaine. He died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Roy attacked two children with a baseball bat. He was sentenced to 30 to 50 years in an institution for the criminally insane in Wisconsin. Warren fell off the back of a fishing boat in Florida while he was drunk. His body has never been recovered. The bald man started drinking 8 weeks after he returned home. His wife threw him out of their house, and his whereabouts are unknown. Bobby was found dead in New Jersey. He had been shot in the back of the head. John was caught carrying 14 ounces of cocaine in San Francisco. He is serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole at San Quentin State Penitentiary in California. Ed was beaten to death in a bar fight in Detroit. Ted was captured by authorities in Mississippi. He is serving a life term without the possibility of parole at Angola State Farm in Louisiana. Maddie was shot and killed outside of a crack house in Minneapolis. Miles is alive and well and continues to serve as a judge. He is still married, had a second child, a daughter named Ella, and he has never relapsed. Leonard returned to Las Vegas and retired. He subsequently died from complications due to AIDS. He was sober until he died. He never relapsed. Lily committed suicide by hanging in a halfway house in Chicago. Her grandmother had passed away 2 days earlier. She was found the morning James was released from jail, and it is believed that she was sober until she died. Lincoln still works at the clinic. Ken still works at the clinic. Hank and Joanne got married. Both still work at the clinic. James has never relapsed. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by L.J. Ganser, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Copyright 2003 by James Fry. Recorded by arrangement with Doubleday, a division of Random House Incorporated. Recording copyright 2018 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.